So we've heard about this is going to be the last presentation for today. We heard a lot about the cultural landscape and about the physical landscape, and I think this group is kind of mixing both, thinking about the physical and cultural landscape of McGill. Where's the presentation?
All right, good morning, everyone. My name's Lindsay. These are my colleagues, Monica, Astrid, and Nick. We'll be presenting to you a natural history of McGill University. So before the arrival of Europeans, the Hochelaga site was occupied by the Iroquois. Years later, the adjacent land became part of McGill's Burnside Estate. One of our main arguments is that this is no accident. Both locations could be shown that they were chosen strategically based on their proximity to water sources and the fertile soil that's ideal for agriculture. It is evident today that the lay of the campus was influenced by the natural environment. This can be seen in Lower Field, which was cleared years and years ago for agriculture and remains fairly clear today. And also in the buildings on Avenue des Pins, which are practically built into the mountain. Our project is a reconstruction of the natural history of the McGill campus. We aim to create a framework for how the Hochelaga project can proceed in future years, but our project has also been designed to stand in its own right. We will use the Burnside Estate as the spatial focus for exploring a variety of topics. While past research has focused on the traditional history and growth of McGill University, our project will show that McGill's success is inextricable from its natural landscape. The topics we'll be presenting today include the geological baseline and those implications for the development that arise from it, the Hochelaga site and the Iroquois that live there, the hydrology and lost streams specific to the McGill campus, the trees of the campus and what they can tell us, the history of James McGill and McGill University, and finally, the relationship between the McGill campus, Montreal, and the natural environment with respect to development over time.
Thanks, Lindsay. I'd like to talk to you now just about the geological baseline. As Tracy and Laura also stressed, this really is important as a point of departure for a project of this nature, a historical reconstruction. It helps us to make really interesting inferences about flora and fauna and also informs present-day considerations of engineering on campus. Just a little bit of background here. This is dawsonite. So this was a mineral that was discovered on campus and was named in honor of McGill's lauded fifth principal, Sir John William Dawson. I want to take you back to a discussion of the Champlain Sea. So this is a depiction where the Champlain Sea would have extended. I mean, it's clear it covered the present-day St. Lawrence River Valley and was quite extensive. So it did arise subsequently from the Quaternary glaciations. And so what happened is you get this influx of Atlantic waters and subsequently the Champlain Sea. Because you no longer have massive ice caps, essentially on top of the depressing the land below, what starts is a process of isostatic rebound. So gradually over the next thousands of years, the Champlain seabed would rise. And this has important implications for the physical environment and flora and fauna. And just a quick mention, so I'm going to specifically talk about the recession of the shorelines and how that's shaped the present-day landscape. So Dawson was a celebrated geologist. He was really interested in this recession of the Champlain Sea shorelines. He gave a really important address in 1857 to the Natural History Society of Montreal, where he detailed the work up until that time to do with the Champlain Sea. He worked with two main sources of information. These were measurements by the Geological Survey and another professor at McGill of the sea margins, so places on the slope face of Montreal where the Champlain Sea tides had actually notched the landscape, and also based on the fossil record and the marine deposits that were left in the St. Lawrence River Valley. Just a quick note, he called these still remains this kind of classification to this day. The two main marine deposits are the Saxagava sand, which is the more shallow littoral deposit, and the Leticlay underlying it, which is the more of the deep seabed. Just to give you an example, so this is the kind of landscape we're looking at. It's a Leticlay deposit near Saint-Jude. So this is what it looks like. It's still here. This is evidence of the glacial retreat that we're speaking of, which led to the formation of the Champlain Sea. As you can see, and Tracy talked about this, it had really interesting implications for our landscape. So in Dawson's address, he talks about specifically the extinction of Leta portlandica and Astarte laurentiana marine shells. So there was it was really quite serendipitous, actually. At the time that he was giving this address, there was an excavation happening on campus. They were working on a water main. So he was able to really get in there and take a look at what was there. So what he found is there is like a transitional layer. So you have the Saxagava sand, this transitional layer, really abundant with fossils, and then the subsequent Leticlay layer. And what he found is there was an extinction of these two deep sea creatures. And based on his geological knowledge, he was able to infer that there were really interesting climatic changes and changes in the physical environment happening due to the isostatic rebound associated with the Champlain Sea. So there was a warming that would have disfavored these deep sea dwellers. And also, the waters themselves were changing. So you were experiencing a change from seawater to estuarial waters to present-day fresh waters in our St. Lawrence River Valley. And just now, to bring you back to the present day, these marine deposits still pose a challenge, as Laura was mentioning, for us and erecting buildings on campus. There was a really interesting master's thesis in the 70s by Ive Mark, and Grace talks about this, he was a professor here at McGill, where they dug a 170-foot experimental drill hole by present-day Burnside Hall and took a look at what is actually the rock profile on our campus. And what they found was interesting. There are clay seams in the bedrock, in the limestone and shale, that that have perched water tables. So this obviously is an engineering concern. You don't want to build on this type of rock profile. So this is areas where there's water above the regional water table. And of course, the surficial deposits themselves, those marine deposits, the Saxagava sand, the Leticlay, they retain a lot of water, anywhere from 30 to 80%. They're subject to liquefaction upon slight pressures, and this is a concern. So thanks, I'll turn it over to Astrid now.
So a bit about the Hochelaga site. So when Jacques Cartier arrived, he was greeted on the banks of the St. Lawrence River by the Iroquois, and then he trudged through a path all the way to what he soon discovered to be the Hochelaga site. So though the official site is still debated today, we will call it the Dawson site, the Hochelaga, because it was discovered near McGill in 1860. So the Dawson site is situated between three streams in the vicinity of the Mont Royal near today's McGill campus. It is a large site that is highly populated and considered to be defensive because of its fortifications. So you can see here a map, a drawing of the Dawson site by Remusio. And there is a debate on over the cause of the abandonment of the site. Whether it is because of warfare or because of the soil not being fertile, because the site was considered to be old at the time, and so the soil had been exhausted. So our group asked ourselves the question, why did the Iroquois choose this site, and why decades, centuries later, why did McGill, James McGill, decide to buy this site? So we were thinking about the soil fertility because we know for a fact, by Cartier's account, that the Iroquois grew a lot of corn and had extensive agriculture with corns and fruit. And we also know from James McGill's diaries and our research that McGill had a fascination for agriculture. And when he bought his 42 acres of land, he had this vision of having this huge garden. And though he did plant a couple of orchards and asparagus, in the end, his land became more of a cattle grazing land.
So.
Hello, everyone. Bonjour. So today I'd like to talk about the hydrology, the theoretical composition of the streams surrounding McGill and Hochelaga. In doing this lovely Google Earth, we used ArcGIS to use old maps, and we attempted to georeference them as best as we could and digitize the streams which were on them. So for this first map here, it's depicting Pendergast's version of Hochelaga and the streams surrounding it. So over here you have the Burnside stream. It's what we will call the traditional Burnside stream model, coming right under the Burnside building into this confluence of all three streams. Here's the McTavish stream, which is, as you can see, is very close proximity to the Hochelaga site. And with this stream, we can sort of see a connection, maybe a stretch to the January 2013 flood on campus, and sort of think about that. This stream here is on Redpath Street, and was likely very crucial in the desirability of one of Montreal's grandiose estates, the Redpath Estate. This is from an 1830 map, and it depicts sort of a different picture here of the Burnside stream. It says that the source is coming from the plateau, which, when thinking about it, we think it may have something to do with sort of more human factors and environment factors. It goes through the Burnside, the traditional model as well. Here, the McTavish stream, the source is around that Drummond and Dr. Penfield. And here's the confluence of all the rivers. So this is a map of 1861, and we can already see a huge change here that only the Burnside stream is plotted. It's, again, the sort of traditional model, but once it gets to Sherbrooke, it seems like the river diverts in a different way, again, likely to do with human factors. In 1875, we see also a sort of differing model of the Burnside stream. It's only within the location of McGill campus. It's more westward in orientation, close to modern-day Graduates Walk, and it ends right at Sherbrooke. So when looking at all these streams in conjunction with one another and these different theories, we as a group really believe that it's more human changes and land use changes than environment per se or natural features. For example, as Montreal grew as an urban city, these streams were probably seen as more of a nuisance than as their previous use for agriculture. So they were likely put down underground, and they may obviously still exist today, but they are within the sewers. Another important point to mention is that the cartographers may have certainly made decisions in deciding on which streams to plot. For example, some cartographers may have seen some streams as just not being important enough to plot. However, it's also important to note that the Pendergast depiction of the Dawson site shows a very clear parallel with the Hochelaga site. We have to bear in mind his purpose in making this.
All right. So, as mentioned before, the land of the Burnside Estate had previously been cleared for agricultural purposes. So when James McGill owned the farm and was still alive, a few trees existed, and they were mostly along the Burnside stream. Dawson actually wrote a paper about the different trees existing on McGill campus and indicates that some of the trees that might have existed along the stream were elms, red oaks, hickory, and willow trees. This is an indication of what the campus might have looked like in the days of James McGill, and we intend for this to be built upon in future years. In 1853, improvements began. One of the most important initiatives was the Graduates Walk, which was planted with elms. It can be seen in the photos just leading up to the Arts Building. So this was completed in 1860. Dawson was also instrumental in landscaping the campus. He planted both native and introduced species. Not only did this serve the purpose of beautifying the campus, but it was also to serve educational goals. The introduced trees served as an experiment to discover which ornamental trees would work in Montreal's climate. And finally, in the 1970s, an onslaught of Dutch elm disease killed many of the trees on campus and in Montreal, notably all the trees along the Graduates Walk, which were all elms. One tree in particular that was a great loss was the Founder's Tree. You can see the stump today encased in concrete in front of the Adams Building. And this tree was either planted or tended to by James McGill because it's so old. This represented the last living link to James McGill, so it's kind of sad to see it go. One last thing, you'll note that the trees along the Graduates Walk today are all of different species. So those in charge of landscaping have learned from the past and applied the knowledge to create a more sustainable future.
So now a bit about James McGill. So James McGill was born on October 6, 1744 in Glasgow, Scotland. After his education in Glasgow, he decided to partake in the fur trade of Eastern Canada, but eventually settled in Montreal. In 1776, he married the Francophone widow called Charlotte de Rivière, and in 1796 purchased 42 acres of land that he later named the Burnside Estate. So in 1801, he decided to create the Royal Institution for the Advancement Learning. But in 1911, it still didn't receive charter, so he decided to draw up a will where he would leave the Burnside Estate and £10,000. But he did put a deadline and said that if within 10 years there still wasn't a charter, all of the Burnside Estate and the £10,000 would go to his wife. In 1813, James McGill died, and McGill didn't receive charter until 1821. The first faculty to open is the Faculty of Medicine in 1829.
So there is considerable debate about James McGill's character. One of his biographers suggested that his sum of money for the Burnside Estate to create McGill College was certainly considerable. However, compared to the other bequests he gave to his other family and friends, it may not be as benevolent as we would think. Professor Frost, one of the most notable historians of McGill, suggests that we shouldn't dismiss him as an establishment man. His money was indeed never intended to act as a full financing for the university, but rather it should be seen as a catalyst to begin the university. The vision for the university was always seen as being an explicitly public institution. McGill, as a man, had great care and respect for young people. He often had younger guests at his home on Notre Dame Street. He was a pioneer in bridging religious and language divides. We can see this as meaning that the institution today should bear in mind its founding values of being accessible for all. McGill married Madame de Olivier, as Astrid mentioned. He was also greatly involved in Francophone social life and culture. He was Protestant, but was involved in overseeing the building and rehabilitation of Catholic churches in Montreal. As mentioned, he did leave money for the university, but in fact, he also did leave money to aid poor Catholics. This is for the time when the religious divide was so apparent, can be seen as very much a progressive move. As a group, we're inclined to agree with Frost's view. He was certainly an establishment man. He was a landowner, a fur trader. Maybe when you met him, he wasn't necessarily charming or had a warm personality, but it's clear that his actions for the period display an indisputable care for the people of his newly naturalized city of Montreal. We find this as being important to bear in mind these founding principles and seeing how the school is essentially based on being tolerant and how it is public in nature. We would like to end with that McGill University has become an anchor for what is presently downtown Montreal. McGill has been shaped by its natural environment and has also been instrumental in shaping the natural landscape. As seen with an event such as the flood in January 2013, these forces continue to persist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're all so enthusiastic that we're running late a bit. So we're going to take a couple of questions. Sophie? And
I just had a question about the Ramusio map. I know like our Hochelag group also looked at it, and we had a kind of a fun time looking at the features of it, and its accuracy obviously has been kind of questioned because there's some say that Ramusio never went to Hochelag or whatever, but are there any features in the Ramusio map that you saw or that you felt like using because you felt that it kind of drew you to the McGill campus? Like, is there a reason why you felt that you wanted to like look at it and maybe see if you could see similarities or?
Well, if you look at the map, there's also like the Mont Royal behind. So I mean, I didn't go into depth because I knew that you were taking up the Hochelaga aspect of it, and also the agriculture around it. I mean, I didn't look in depth into it, but also just mainly for the mountain, it's the location. though obviously the accuracy is questionable, but the general location seemed quite relevant to where the Dawson site is.
No other questions?
Yeah. I'm wondering if you have any ideas in terms of how your understanding of the history may now help inform your thinking about the present and sustainability and the link there.
Well, I think when I realized that the McTavish stream went down that same particular course, it just seemed, although they were two completely separate events, it just seems so connected. I think we learned from our project, we elaborated more in this for our paper, that, for example, the fact how Oshawaga was abandoned in such a sudden way really sort of represents like how, as a university, we need to really think about our relationship with the environment, because somewhere just down the street just disappeared just like that and was what was discovered. Another thing that we sort of thought about for sustainability was the Dutch elm disease, and how, even though that was quite relatively more recent, it's just something to bear in mind. Like, at least it seems like we're learning from our lessons by planting trees on Graduates Row of different species. So I think it just sort of brings the message of sustainability a little closer to home, considering that a lot of the things that have shaped McGill can serve as lessons for sustainability for the future now and forevermore.
I think this is a very good ending, Nick, that you just provided us.
We'll end there.
Yeah. So I'd like to thank all the students who presented this this morning. I think this is, you just said it, we are going to learn from the past to envision a better future. Thank you very much.